Let's take our Bible again tonight and turn to 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter 2. And tonight we're going to look at a shorter passage, verses 18 through 20. Did anybody not get a handout and you need one? All right, keep your hand up. Chad, would you be able to, they're right outside the back door there. Looks like we just need one up front here. 1 Peter 2. 18 through 20. Tonight we're going to look at the topic of doing good even when it's not fair. And so let's go ahead and open up with a word of prayer, and we will launch right in. Father, I thank you so much for your word. Thank you that you are using it to shape us, to make us more like Jesus Christ. Lord, we pray that you would renew our minds tonight. Please, would your Holy Spirit empower us and illuminate us as we look at your word. We know that your word is a lamp to our feet, but we must understand it. Please help us. I pray that you would receive the glory and honor through our obedience tonight to your word. Help us to know exactly what we need to do this week based on what you've spoken to us. And we pray for your blessing now. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, let's read this passage and then we're going to dive in. 1 Peter 2, 18 through 20. Peter says, "Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. For this is a gracious thing. When mindful of God, one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. For what credit is it if, when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? But if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God." I want to give us just a little bit of a review, kind of a run-up to this passage so we know where we've been. You probably have heard this many times, but it doesn't hurt to go over it again. The first Peter really divides into three sections, and we've already taken a good look at the first section, chapter 1 through chapter 2 and verse 10. And in that section, Peter really told us who we are as exiles. Who are we? And he tells us that we are exiles. We are on our way to our inheritance. He tells us that we are en route to an inheritance that is kept in heaven for us. He told us about our great salvation in Jesus Christ. And by the time you get to the end of that first section, really your heart is filled with joy and thankfulness for what God has done for us. We live in a dark world, but we are people who have hope, real hope. And so Peter has been telling us about this hope. And then he gets to chapter 2 and verse 11. And he says, okay, now based on who you are a unique people. Based on that, now you need to have unique behavior. Look what he says in verse 11 of chapter 2. "Beloved, I urge you now as sojourners and exiles," that's who you are, "now abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against your soul." And what he does is he urges these exiles to have a lifestyle that is so uniquely different from everybody else, that when people look at us, we stand out. And people notice there's something different about us. There's something unique about us. Our behavior is different. And our behavior is supposed to be different so that, look at verse 13, so that even when they speak against you as evildoers, so they're slandering us unjustly, then they take a closer look. They take a closer look at the way we behave in difficult situations. And what happens? They see your good deeds. And then they too are brought out of darkness into his marvelous light. And one day they glorify God on the day of visitation. Not everyone, but some people are going to look at our behavior and say, that person's different. That person really is unique. And when they see that, they glorify God on the day of visitation. And what Peter does after he says that in verse 12 is he really launches into three situations. Three situations in which our behavior needs to be unique. We already looked at the first situation, and that is the public square. And Peter says that when you get into the public square, when you get into the political world, which all of us, whether we like it or not, have to be in at points, you are going to come face to face with imperfect rulers. Is that true? It's true, isn't it? Imperfect rulers. And he says the way that you respond to those rulers is going to show that you are unique. There's something different about you, different from everybody else. The next situation you're going to find yourself in is the workplace. And he says when you get into the workplace, you're going to come face to face with unjust masters, unjust bosses. They're not going to be fair. And he says the way you respond to this injustice is going to show the world there's something different about you. You are unique. And the third situation you're going to find yourself in is the home. How many of us found ourselves in that situation today? Yeah, all of us, right? And he says when you get into the home, you're going to see that a wife might find herself in a situation where she comes face to face with an unbelieving husband, or we could broaden out a little bit, an unbelieving family member. And when that happens, we are going to show the world that there's something different about us. Now, how do we show the world that there's something different about us? What's the command that he gives in all three of these situations? Do you see it? He says it in verse 13, be subject. And then verse 18, servants, be subject. And then chapter 3 and verse 1, likewise, wives, be subject. Now, why does Peter go there? Why does he say, be subject in all three of these cases? What we find is that these three situations are not easy situations, right? None of them are. Imperfect rulers, unjust masters, unbelieving husbands, none of that's easy. In fact, these are the pressure-filled situations of life. And what we find is that the Christian, his behavior shines the brightest when his circumstances are the darkest. You know, the world is going to see that something is different about us when we find ourselves in a hot water situation, in a pressure situation, and we respond differently from everybody else. Our lives don't shine the brightest when our circumstances are pleasant and good. Our lives shine the brightest when our circumstances are dark. Our uniquely Christian behavior shows up best when pressure is applied. I think all of us have probably found ourselves in some sort of pressure situation this week, some sort of uncomfortable situation. And maybe when you found yourself in that situation, you found that it was due in part to the fact that you were a Christian, the fact that you were following Jesus Christ. You were going against the flow, against the current of this world. And Peter says it's right there. It's in that moment that our behavior needs to be uniquely Christian. And how do we do that? Peter says you do that by submitting. Submitting. Be subject. Be subject. Be subject, Peter says. But this is not any old submission. This isn't just turn over and this person can tell you whatever and you do it. That's not the kind of submission this is. In fact, look again at verse 13. Verse 13 really starts with what we could call a header for this whole section. And that is, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution. Pastor Mark talked about this. That word institution is the word creature. Be subject to every human institution ordained by God. But how are we supposed to be subject? Look at that phrase there. For the Lord's sake. That's the kind of submission. This is a submission that is based in our relationship with God. A submission that is focused on the Lord. And it's a submission that's actually going to result in sometimes having to disobey authority because our focus is on God. And we'll see that here in our passage that we're looking at tonight. This is a submission for the Lord's sake. It is a God-fearing, uniquely Christian thing. And so we've already addressed the political realm. We addressed what to do when we come face to face with imperfect rulers. And we're going to, in future weeks, address the family. What to do when you come face to face with an unbelieving family member and the conflict that results from that. But tonight, we're going to launch into an equally pressure-filled space. It's the workplace. I remember when I first got my first secular job, I had had a Bible degree and then a seminary graduate degree. But none of that prepared me for the pressure that I felt in that workplace. The pressure that it was to be a Christian when nobody else around you is a Christian or is acting like a Christian. There is a lot of pressure there. And the way we respond in that situation is going to show the world what kind of God we have. And so Peter, he just launches right into that space. And really, this is going to be difficult because he addresses it. He begins with the word servants. And that's an interesting word. That is actually not the typical word for slave. It's the word that means household slaves. These were people in the Roman Empire who were not owned by the government. They were owned by private citizens, and they made up a huge percentage of the Roman population at the time. Many of them were younger. Many of them were teenagers. So a lot of the people that Peter is writing to who are going to be hearing this, and this applies to them, they would probably be teenage Christians, people who had just begun as a slave, and they're learning what it is to work for a master. What was it like to be a slave in ancient Rome? Well, in urban areas of Rome, and that is some of the areas that Peter is writing to, one out of every three people was a slave. In fact, in Pergamum, in the ancient city of Pergamum, which is one of the seven letters that John writes to in Revelation, and most likely read this letter by Peter, it was estimated that there were 40,000 household slaves there at the time. Now, what did they do? If you walked into a normal Roman home, a lot of times you would find several slaves, depending on the wealth of that home. And many of them were actually born in the home. Sometimes a slave would sell himself into slavery to pay a debt or maybe even to save money. But typically, these were people who had been born into the home. And we find that sometimes their circumstances were okay, that it wasn't always terrible. And Peter even infers that here when he says, not only to the good and the gentle. You see, some masters were actually good and gentle to their slaves, as far as it goes, even though they were slaves, which is a terrible thing. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Not all slaves did menial tasks. If you walked into a wealthy first century home, you'd probably see many slaves at work, and you would see them doing things other than menial tasks. You would see them nannying or tutoring children. Sometimes you would see them working as domestic laborers or farmhands. Sometimes you'd even see a slave who was acting as a household secretary or a financial advisor. Sounds a little bit like some of our occupations today, right? So these are people who are doing some pretty advanced work. It's also different from the slavery that we've had in our country's history in recent time. It was not based on race. Many times the slaves were well-educated, education was encouraged, and they were paid. And sometimes they were paid even a decent salary to the point where at some point they could possibly buy their freedom back. Sometimes these slaves would even be so close to the family that they would become part of the family. The family loved these people, and they would even find their way into the family burial plot. That was how close they were to the family. Sometimes they had good relationships with their masters, but sometimes they did not. And that is where Peter says, also to the unjust. Some masters were very cruel, despite the fact that Rome legislated heavily the slavery of the time, despite the fact that there was social pressure to treat your slaves well. Some masters treated their slaves very poorly. First of all, they were slaves, and that was a great issue in the time. Slavery was a terrible thing, a terrible plague on Rome at this time. Even though they had sometimes even sold themselves into that position, once they were in that position, it was involuntary. And they were often not treated as normal citizens. Sometimes they weren't even treated as people. They were sometimes treated more like a farm implement or like a piece of furniture. Sometimes the masters would punish them harshly with shackles and beatings and tortures and abuse. Many times they were branded on their forehead so that they could never run away, or if they did run away, they would be quickly returned to their master. Sometimes they were given freedom only when they were so elderly that they had lost their ability to work, and they would be sent to the streets to beg. The life expectancy of an average slave in Rome at this time was 17 years of age, which was much lower than the average population. So what we see is that in many ways, this is similar to a workplace, but it's a very pressure-filled workplace. And that's, I think, what Peter is getting at, is that this is not just any old workplace. This is a workplace where there is injustice. This is a workplace where things are not as they should be. And yet I think that for those of us who are here as Americans, we are not slaves, but we do, many of us, have employers. And so we can take some of the applications that are given here, and we can then apply it to our own situation. We can also apply it to any situation where we enter the professional world and we come face to face with other people, whether it be selling or buying or some sort of service. So what we can do is take the application here, and we can see what the Lord has for us today. And what we see is that really Peter's focus is on the times when life is not fair. Sometimes life's not fair. You know, you learn that when you're a little kid, don't you? You hear little kids say that a lot. That's not fair. And as we grow older, we realize that truly life is not fair. And when life is not fair, so often, even as Christians, we respond with resistance, with frustration, with anger. And so Peter wants to tell us that when you experience injustice, not just in the workplace, but in your neighborhood, in your school, with your classmates, with your coworkers, how can you respond in a uniquely Christian way when you face that kind of injustice? And what Peter tells us in this passage is that exiles can continue doing good. Keep doing good, even in the face of injustice. And how can we do that? By fearing God alone. By fearing God alone. And fearing God requires that you and I remember two truths. And those are the truths on your handout. Like, one, God is your ultimate master. And two, God has the final say. First of all, God is your ultimate master. Take a look at verse 18. Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. We see, first of all, in this passage, a God-fearing submission. First word that we need to notice there is the word be subject. We already saw this. Pastor Mark pointed this out in the last passage, but this is a voluntary submission. This is not forced. This is, I am willing to be subject. Be subject to your masters with all respect, or the original language says, in all fear. So who are we fearing? Are we fearing this master? Or are we fearing God? And Peter doesn't really answer that question in this verse, but I think we can get some hints from the rest of the book. Whenever Peter uses the word fear in this letter, it always refers to fear of God. In fact, there are twice in this book where Peter warns against fearing people. He says, don't fear people, fear God, fear him alone. In fact, the verse right before this, verse 17, Peter has used this same word. Look what he says, honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. And just one breath later, he says, now be subject to masters with all fear. I believe it's pretty clear that this is the fear of God. So once again, this is not just any old submission. This is uniquely Christian submission. This is a submission where you walk into the workplace and this man who's your boss, he's not your ultimate boss. And all day long, you're thinking, I've got another boss. I've got an ultimate boss, and that is God, and I fear him. And everything I do today, all of my behavior, all of my choices, I'm going to make because I fear him. Now, what kind of fear is this? Is this fear and trepidation? Well, really, it's the same kind of fear that was described earlier in the book, chapter 1 and verse 17. He says, and if you call on him as Father who judges impartially according to each one's deeds, conduct yourselves with fear throughout the time of your exile. What kind of fear is this? It's the kind of fear that you would give to a loving, just father. I've probably used this illustration before, but sometimes we dads, we like to get down on all fours and pretend like we're a lion or a bear, chase our kids around the house. And as a dad, you kind of pride yourself on being as loud as possible, as scary as possible. And your kids, you know, they're running around, they're screaming. And then at some point, what do? We go too far, right? We take it too far. And we roar too loud or something. And the kid goes from happy squeals to scared squeals, right? He's afraid. But instead of running from you, he runs to you, right? And he gives you a big hug. And why? Because you're his dad. And even though he's afraid of you, he runs to you because he knows that you're his father and he trusts you. And that's the kind of fear, I think, that's being described here. It's the kind of fear that you give to a God who is so great and so powerful and magnificent, and yet at the same time, he's your father. And so you fear him. That's the kind of fear that Peter describes here. And so your behavior toward your boss, toward your coworker, toward those in the professional world with you, your behavior is guided by and empowered by your relationship to God. Now notice that this kind of submission is not always going to result in pleasing your master. In the very next verse, your master is actually beating you. Two verses later, he is beating this servant because apparently they disobeyed him. But Peter says that your goal is not to always and forever please your master. Your goal is to please God. And everything you do throughout your day is to please God. That is why in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul describes slaves as actually being free. You know, the New Testament writers, they do not say for slaves to rise up and march and protest slavery, even though slavery was a great evil. What they do say is that you actually undermine the evil of slavery by living as free people who are slaves of God. And when you go back to that master, when you go back to that workplace, and you begin to live with uniquely Christian behavior, something very powerful happens. The glory of God is displayed. God shows his excellencies. So it's a God-fearing submission, but then it is a countercultural submission. Because when you fear God, when you walk into your workplace and your focus is on pleasing God and God alone, you're going to behave differently from everybody else. Because you're not just going to submit to the good and the gentle, you're also going to submit to the unjust. The word literally means crooked. You're going to submit to the boss who is dishonest regarding pay, who is unfair regarding working conditions, who is unpredictable with your expectations. And this runs against the grain of our world, doesn't it? Our world would say, never put up with that. You don't need to put up with that. But as Christians, we have a higher calling. Now, some of you might be thinking, well, wait a minute. We live in America. We're free. We can get out of that situation, and there might be times when we need to get out of a situation that is unfair and unjust. But Peter, remember who he's talking to. He's talking to slaves. He is talking to people who cannot get out from under this situation without a large sum of money. And so he addresses them right where they are, right in the middle of that unfair circumstance. And the truth is that today, there are some unfair circumstances which we cannot escape, which are going to continue to come at us. And so what does Peter do? He says, you need to respond with countercultural behavior. One time, I heard a story about a man named Howard Hendricks, who wrote a book called Living by the Book. And he was a preacher and a book author. And one day he was on an American Airlines flight, and he noticed behind him that a flight attendant was having some struggles with a very unruly passenger. The man was angry, he was belligerent, he was rude, and this flight attendant just continued to deal with him in a professional, kind, gracious way. And it really stuck out to Howard Hendricks. And so when the flight was over, he made his way back to the flight attendant and just commended her for her behavior and said, hey, I would love to write a letter or a note of commendation to American Airlines or to your boss. And she said this without skipping a beat. She said, I don't work for American Airlines, I work for Jesus Christ. And you know, I think we all know that, don't we? But do we live that way? Do we operate day in and day out with, he's my master, he's my ultimate master, my submission must be to him? Obedience to God is the primary goal, and it is the greatest consolation when we face unfair circumstances. And throughout this book, throughout even these pressure-filled situations, Peter keeps doing this. He keeps directing our attention to God. When you walk into work, God walks into work with you. When you have commendable behavior at work and nobody notices, God notices. He is there with you. He's empowering you. He's strengthening you. He has given you this book to guide you throughout your day. Your ultimate master is God himself. And so because of that, we submit. We have countercultural behavior. Why do we do this? Because this goes against our nature. It goes against our grain. None of us likes to subordinate ourselves under someone who is unfair. Nobody likes that. So why would we ever do this? Why should I obey a boss who will never notice or appreciate me? And Peter has a few things to say about this, but his first answer is found in verses 19 through 20, and that is this, that God has the final say. Not only is he your ultimate master, but he has the final say. We see in verse 19 that God rewards endurance in the face of suffering. Look at verse 19. He says, you need to submit. Why? For this is a gracious thing. Let's stop there. Peter says that again at the end of verse 20, doesn't he? This is a gracious thing in the sight of God. And so what we see is this reason for submitting is bookended with this explanation. This is a gracious thing. But if you're like me, you see the words gracious thing and you think, I don't know if I know what that means. And the truth is, the original language is even a little more ambiguous. It simply says, for this is grace. And he uses that word grace. And what do we know about grace? Well, that's God's unmerited, undeserved favor, right? But how would that fit here? For this is grace, when mindful of God, one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. And then, in verse 20, if when you do good and suffer it for it, you endure, this is grace in the sight of God. What does that mean? Well, I think we can find out a little bit about what that means if we look at another passage, Luke chapter 6, verses 32 through 36. And we'll put these up on the screen. I believe Peter is using the word grace in the same way that Jesus used the word grace in Luke chapter 6. Let's look at this passage together. Jesus says, same kind of topic, if you love those who love you, that's easy, what benefit is that to you? And I've put that word in red because that's our word. That's actually the word grace. So let's start over. If you love those who love you, what grace is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what grace is that to you? That's not out of the ordinary. What grace is that? For even sinners do the same. Then verse 34, and if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Different word, but same idea. Even sinners lend to sinners to get back the same amount. And here's Jesus' point, verse 35, love your enemies. That is countercultural right there. Love your enemies and do good, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. Be merciful, even as your Father is merciful. And I've put that word reward in red, not because it's the word grace, but I think it actually explains how Jesus is referring to the word grace. How's he using this? He's using grace to show that if you have this countercultural behavior, it proves, first of all, that you're God's child, because only God's children act this way. And not only that, but God is pleased, and you have an inheritance coming. You have a reward coming, not because you're good, but because you are the child of God. So let's go back to 1 Peter then. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 19, he says, for this is grace. When mindful of God, one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. So what does he mean here? How is he using the word grace? We could say that grace is actually referring to the reward God has for those who are his children. And he's already talked about this reward in chapter 1 and verse 3 when he talked about our inheritance. Remember that? We have an inheritance coming. We are going to receive this inheritance. And this inheritance is not in any way based on us. It's based completely on God's mercy, and it's kept by the power of God. And yet, Peter says here, if you are the kind of person who is suffering for doing good, that is an indicator that you are on the path to glory. That is an indicator that you have an inheritance coming. You have a reward because God rewards those who continue to endure in the face of suffering. These uniquely Christian behaviors, even if they don't please anybody else, they please God. And he has the final say. So how are we going to do this? Well, he says, this is grace, and this is a gracious thing, when mindful of God. Once again, this has to do with our relationship with God. That word simply means conscious of God, thinking about God. Our relationship with God guides our actions in the face of injustice. When we step into an unfair situation, God is on our mind. And we think about the fact that we are his children and we need to behave in a way that would bring glory to him. So, when we face an unfair situation at work, we don't need to repay or resist, or resent, or rebel, because we know God. Because we know the kind of God we serve, and we know that he gets the final say on our life. And as this situation unfolds, we not only will face unfair situations, we'll also experience pain. Look what he says. You're mindful of God, and you begin to endure sorrows while suffering unjustly. So here's what's happened. This slave, this 15-year-old slave, has said, I fear God, and therefore I am going to not do what my master has asked, because I am submitting in the fear of God, and he's punished for it. He suffers for it. And this slave could then think to himself, well, that's not fair. Am I even doing the right thing? This doesn't seem right. And Peter says, no, you're exactly where you need to be. That's exactly what happens to those who fear God. But our relationship with God, it guides the way we think about suffering. Suffering acts like the blazes on a trail. Anybody ever hiked a trail that uses colored blazes on trees or rocks? Anybody? So sometimes you go into a park and they'll have 7 different trails and they'll color each trail with different blazes. And so when what you do is you say, okay, I'm going to go down the red blazed trail. And so you look for paint on trees or rocks to make sure you're on the right trail. And I tend to overthink it. And so if I haven't seen a red blaze for a while, I start to think, did I take a wrong turn? Am I on the right trail? And then you see one. It's on a rock or it's on a tree. And you know when you see that blaze, I'm on the right trail. I'm doing the right thing. Well, suffering in many ways acts like a blaze on the Christian life. And many of us would think the opposite, right? We would think, boy, I'm suffering for doing good. Maybe I'm not on the right trail. And Peter says, no, if you're suffering for doing good, that means you are on the right trail. You're on the path to glory. You're on the path to your future reward. And so every time we see that blaze of suffering, Peter says that needs to be a comfort. That is actually a good sign. It proves that you are on the trail to glory, the path to glory. But Peter says one word at the very end of verse 19, which is really important. You see that word? It's the word unjustly. How important is that, that our suffering be unjust? Well, it's pretty important. Because Peter takes the next verse to explain just how important it is that you suffer for doing good and not for doing evil. Look what he says in verse 20. For what credit is it if when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? That's no credit at all. That's just like everybody else. Everybody else is going to get punished for doing evil. Peter says, don't do that. Don't be on that path. Instead, if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, and it's implied that you endure in doing good, you keep doing good, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. Peter is telling us here, don't suffer for wrongdoing. Don't be known as the gossip at work. Don't be known as the person who wastes time at the office. Don't be known for sin. Don't be known as a Christian as just like everybody else, following the course of this world. You know, increasingly, it seems like in our day, Christians often become known for pretty bad things. And in many cases, it's true. The Christian really has engaged in that behavior. Peter says, don't go there. Don't do that. Instead, when you walk into work, you are not your own boss. God is. Follow him. Don't be known for doing wrong. Instead, be known for doing good. Now, this phrase, doing good, it's huge in 1 Peter. He says it again and again, and we actually saw it in Luke chapter 6, didn't we? In many ways, Peter is echoing the words of Jesus, and he says, you as Christians, if you want to have uniquely Christian behavior in the public square, in the workplace, at the home, you need to do good. We see it in verse 12. We see it in verse 14, chapter 3 and verse 6, verse 13. Good deeds done for an unjust boss, for a bad boss. Good deeds done for a bad coworker or a bad neighbor. Good deeds done in the face of great injustice brings God great glory and reveals the grace of God. And that's where it gets tough, isn't it? Because that's where we want to say, well, wait a minute, I have my rights. And we do in many cases, right? In many cases, we do have the option to back out of a situation. When we are falsely accused or suffer for doing good, we want to rise up. We want to seek justice. We want to retaliate. We want to resent. We want to protect ourselves. But what does Peter say to do? He says, keep doing good. If there's one thing you need to do when you face injustice, it's good. You need to keep doing good. Now, how in the world are we going to do this? Because like I said, this is not only countercultural, it's really counterintuitive. It goes against the grain of the way we think. How are we going to do this? Well, we do this because our focus is not on our boss. It's not on our neighbor. It's not even on ourselves. It's on our God. And we know he's the ultimate master and he has the final say. Peter said this in chapter 1 and verse 7. He said, you have been subjected to suffering for a time. How? So that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. The end of the story has already been written. So this 15-year-old slave in a home of an unjust Roman civilian, he knows the end of the story. He's just heard from Peter that he's got an inheritance coming. He's just heard from Peter that his inheritance is guarded, that he himself is guarded. And so because of that, he can walk back into that unfair situation and he can follow the Lord. Now, we also need to make sure we exercise wisdom. And remember what we said here. This kind of submission is not just roll over and this person can tell me whatever they want to tell me. That's not the kind of submission. This is submission in the fear of God. So this is the kind of submission that is going to make you come face to face with people that aren't pleased with you. It's the kind of submission that is going to possibly cause some conflict. And yet as we do this, the world will notice that, boy, this person's different. There is something unique. There is some uniquely Christian behavior going on here. Now, Peter doesn't actually address evangelism in this passage. Do you notice that? He already addressed evangelism back in verse 12. He says, if your conduct is honorable, then they will see your good deeds and they'll glorify God on the day of visitation. So there is that hope. But Peter doesn't actually address it in the passage we've just looked at. Now, I think there is great hope that people in our circles, people in our workplace are going to see us and say, boy, they're different. But I think the point that Peter is driving at is not evangelism just yet in this passage. What he's driving at is that even if nobody else notices what you do at work, what you do at home, how you continue to do good deeds, even if nobody else sees, God does. And that's what matters. Now, in the next passage, we're going to see that not only are we fearing God, but we're also following the greatest servant of all time. And this is a servant who didn't just come to be served. He came to give his life as a ransom for many. He came to suffer in our place. And so there's some evangelism right there. Jesus, the greatest servant, he served so that he could save. And as we serve, we point people to him. I'm looking forward to looking at that passage in the coming weeks.